I'm an anxious television watcher. I'm sure you'd have never guessed. I prefer to say that I'm good at suspending disbelief. It's important for a TV watcher as avid as I to be able to suspend disbelief. And if you can't do that, please don't ever get into a discussion with me about Harry Potter, Skyrim, the Marvel Universe, or pretty much anything in the fantasy science fiction genre. Suspending disbelief in fantasy fiction involves understanding that magic has rules, and also knowing that magic, as defined by the author, does not actually exist. This happens in science fiction as well, and some men have built careers on simple rule interactions. For example, almost everything Isaac Asimov writes revolves around his three laws of robotics, as it refers to the positronic brain. Those three laws are such. 1. A robot may not injure a human being, or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Rule number 2. A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. Number 3. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws. And because he spends so much time working out these laws and exploring theory around them over time, the narrative actually gives birth to a preemptive law, the zeroth law, that regards humanity as a whole and says that the robot may not disregard the protection of humanity. The movie iRobot dealt with this concept, even though it did it badly. Building this system is called world building, and one of the most important parts of writing fantasy and science fiction. The world must have rules, and the author must choose how these rules would be applied and when to break them. Many writers in fiction for book, screen, or even video games will get so hung up on understanding the world that they never get around to writing the story. Though if they're good, not only do they write the story, but they offer us a copy of the rules in beautiful poetic fashion. J.R.R. Tolkien writes an elaborate story in The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings, but without his notebooks upon notebooks of information, of world building, the stories would never nearly resonate as they do. And though Tolkien never intended to publish The Silmarillion, we are glad he did. And communities love these little interactions. The interactions with rules and regulations. We love a well-thought-out system of magic. Eons of history building up to a final confrontation that comes thousands of years in the future or in the past. We spend hours talking about Iluvatar and the Valor. We feel smug when we understand that Gandalf was actually named Mithrandir, that he is a Maia, and that Sauron is no one compared to Melkor, whom the elves called Morgoth. So many, not me, of course, would ask why in the world this author, with this much foresight, saves the main protagonist at the end of The Lord of the Rings with giant eagles that to this point we have not seen in the story. Some, as I said, not me, would call this a deus ex machina. Now, Superman flying around the world backwards to make it go back in time to save Lois Lane, that's a deus ex machina. Or aliens that took so much time in War of the Worlds to travel to this planet and subjugate its peoples have to leave because they didn't check to see which inoculations they would need before they got here. That's deus ex machina. Deus ex machina literally translates to God out of the machine. And it dates back to ancient Greek theater, I've heard it was rather literal. When the protagonist had no way of surviving, they would lower men playing the gods onto the stage with a big machine to save the day. There are four basic rules to define Deus Ex Machina, and I pulled these from a website called TV Tropes, so you're welcome to disagree. Deus Ex Machina are solutions to a problem. They are never unexpected developments that make things worse, nor sudden twists that only change the understanding of the story. Deus Ex Machina are sudden or unexpected. This means that even if they are featured, referenced, or set up earlier in the story, they do not change the course of, nor appear as, natural or viable solutions to the plot line they eventually solve. It's also used to resolve a situation portrayed as unsolvable or hopeless. If the problem could be solved with a bit of common sense or other types of simple intervention, the solution is not a Deus Ex Machina, no matter how unexpected it may seem. They are also external to the characters and the choices throughout the story. The solution comes from a character with a small or non-existent influence on the plot until that point, or random chance from nature or karma. So many critics, modern and ancient, would label the use of Deus Ex Machina in fiction and in anything as lazy and generally inconsistent with the inner logic of the story. Basically, it punishes those of us who are really good at suspending disbelief. I, however, just me, would argue that a well-placed Deus Ex Machina can be very complementary to the narrative, especially when the narrative finds itself naturally in a no-win situation. And though my life does follow a certain set of natural laws, there are many times in my personal life that resolution has felt like God being descended by a machine. And I will admit that once in a while I've caught myself waiting on the machine to grant me salvation by God. In his collection of essays called Being Human Religiously, James Luther Adams says regarding what he calls the fifth stone of religious liberalism, "Liberalism holds that the resources, divine and human, are available for achievement of meaningful change, justify an attitude of ultimate optimism, though this view does not necessarily involve immediate optimism." I took a test once to see how I should manage my 401k. It asked me all kinds of questions about age, how long I plan on working. Do I understand the general ups and downs of the stock market? I've always been told in retirement planning, though many of you may understand this better than I do, that I should take the long view. Invest for a larger gain in the beginning, even though it means there's less stability. And as I get older, move my investments to safer funds so that I can reduce the chance of loss. Basically, they wanted to know if I understood that the market falls every now and again, and if I wouldn't panic, and they wanted to know if I wouldn't panic every time that happened. Because according to this concept, it's time that generates even growth. I suppose my retirement is considered long and bending towards fully funding all future cruises and vacations over time. That if I'm patient and I choose not to retire, or not to panic, I will get to retire. This is thus to be seen. Because despair is easy, especially when God isn't allowed to use the machine. But the machine is a funny thing, isn't it? In Ephesians 6, it says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord that his mighty and his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realm. Therefore, put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. And after you have done everything to stand, stand firm then with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, with the breastplate of righteousness in place, with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith in which you can extinguish all flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. See, I've always loved the middle of that passage. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood. The KJV, it says our struggle is against the powers and the principalities. I love that, the powers and the principalities. It talks about the kings of all ages. That these are the things aligned with evil. And we stand and we fight. I was introduced to Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit while researching this sermon. I hope you don't mind that instead of reading the 1944 French play, I watched the 1964 BBC version of it. When it comes to plays, I would rather see them played out as opposed to reading them. But when it comes to most things, I would rather see them played out as opposed to reading them. They just always seem to make more sense that way. A man, Joseph Garçon, finds himself in hell and asks the concierge. Yes, hell has a concierge. Where are the torturers? The concierge wasn't really helpful with this answer. Actually, none of his answers were really helpful. The room, white, art on the wall, three benches that no one could move. Later, Garçon would be met with Inez Serrano and Estelle Regault. Over time, they confess to each other their sins, but as they do this, they confess something greater to each other. Sadly, they confess their inability to meet each other's needs and to help each other meet them. Garçon needs Inez to know he is no coward. Inez needs Estelle to love her. Estelle needs to feel beautiful, and though Inez would love to grant her this gift, she only wants it from Garçon. And since Garçon will always see Inez and interpret her stare as judgment, he can give nothing to Estelle. And as they realize that they're tortured, they are the torturers, Garçon says something very powerful. There is no need for hot pokers in this place. Hell is other people. Adams would describe them as living in the void of meaninglessness. Because meaning is shared in community. In No Exit, the three main characters were unable to step away from their own self-loathing and their own emotional needs long enough to notice that they would never get them met because they couldn't meet them for each other. Their souls ache for community that is regularly denied. And I ask, what is a soul? Is it connected to your body? Well, maybe I don't ask, but the 1995 sci-fi action spy thriller anime Ghost in the Shell does. Confronting many stereotypes and asking many questions, giving light indirectly to cultural identities that may hold too little or in some cases too much authority over our lives or at least our expectations. If you've already watched the anime, I don't have to explain to you the importance of Ghost in the Shell. There's a core of required viewing if one is really to embrace the culture of this genre. So that we understand that this is not a cartoon, but a window into cultural understanding. We know specifically that without Ghost in the Shell, there is no Matrix. The Wachowski brothers, after watching Ghost in the Shell, came up with an idea. I should say the Wachowskis. They came up with an idea and said, let's make that into a movie. Let's make that live action. And from that's where The Matrix happened. Ghost asks us to question how we define who we are. I have to admit that I get lost watching the movie. But this is because of its subgenre. I've never been too keen on spy thrillers. It's where the movie deviates that I'm drawn in. The title alone, The Ghost, a reference to base consciousness. The Shell, a reference to the thing that encases that base consciousness. The story asks us, do my insides and outsides have to match? Of course, one may ask if Hong Kong, the city of inspiration for the city in the movie, is asking the same question in 1995. It was still considered a British colony and had 2 years before it would be returned to China. And at that point, does Hong Kong become China? Or does Hong Kong remain Western? It is the thing that defines who we are, what we are. And where does my ghost reside? This movie alludes to the idea of ultimate connection, mind and body, mind to community, but grows beyond the simple binaries of male and female, body and soul, inside and outside, individual and collective. Often people want to know of me, do you believe in God? I was once met with many a harsh word when I refused to answer the question simply. The problem is, I define my atheism with so many caveats that there's little need to define it. I define my theism with the same frustrating conditions. So when I say God, soul, church, know that the referent is complicated beyond belief, as it should be. James Luther Adams says, the love of God, then, is giving oneself to the power that holds the world together, in that when we are tearing it apart, persuades us to come to ourselves and start on new beginnings. It is not bound to achieve evil, and it is not bound to achieve good. Jesus on the cross, just before he died, said to his Father, into your hands I commend my spirit, but still wasn't afraid to ask, why have you forsaken me? I realize now, as I begin to close this sermon, that the entire introduction, the discussion of the tropes of the Deus Ex Machina, was actually just a MacGuffin. Another trope, which means the idea that drives the story forward. See, the fourth stone of liberal religion by James Luther Adams, we deny the immaculate conception of virtue and affirm the necessity of social interaction. We are not good by individual merit. We are good through communal interaction. As James put it, a different James, faith without works is dead. We express our faith through our work in society. We are not just individuals. We are members of a society, a community, and a church. And hope is the bridge that connects us. Because when we take the long view of history, our small steps, connected with each other's, change hearts and mind. We connect those steps with the steps of others, and our movements run marathons. But only if we stand together. And here we might just find that heaven is just people. And we are the thing that descends from the machine. Thank you.